On Sunday evenings, we're reading through the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel grew up in the city of Jerusalem, the capital city of the nation of Israel. Ezekiel was training to be a priest. He was preparing to spend his life working in God's temple there in Jerusalem. But when Ezekiel was 25 years old, his world collapsed. The army of the king of Babylon marched against Jerusalem. The Israelites in Jerusalem surrendered. The Babylonians marched into the city. They looted the temple. They arrested the king and the royal family. They rounded up most of the leading citizens. And they took them all back as prisoners to Babylon. And Ezekiel was among them. Ezekiel was deported from the land of Israel to the land of Babylon, the country that we now call Iraq. That was in the year 597 BC. The Babylonians didn't destroy Jerusalem at that point. They left the poorest people behind. They installed a new king who was really just going to be their puppet. They left the temple standing. Life just went on in Jerusalem. And the people who were still there were still hopeful. They kept telling themselves that things were going to get better. In fact, they told themselves that God was going to destroy the power of Babylon very soon, and the folk who had been carried off to Babylon would soon be coming home again. They really believed that there was still a golden age for Israel just round the corner. They kept saying, it'll only take a couple of years, it'll only take a couple of years, and all our problems will be over. There were people who called themselves prophets, who said that that was what God was planning to do. They had no doubt that God was still on their side. But meanwhile, Ezekiel was an exile in far-off Babylon. He was living in some sort of prisoner of war camp or shanty town near the Chebar Canal, which cut across the desert near the city of Babylon. Ezekiel was there for 5 years. He reached the age of 30, the age at which he would have started work as a priest if he had still been in Jerusalem. And it was at that point in time that God appeared to Ezekiel. Ezekiel had an extraordinary vision of God. And if you've been here for the last few Sunday evenings, you'll know what a mind-blowing, terrifying, awesome vision Ezekiel had of God. Ezekiel, in his vision, sees God coming in a vast storm, sweeping towards him with hurricane force, blazing with light and fire, riding on all the powers of nature, and using them as his chariot, sitting on a vast throne, ready to make war against his enemies. It was utterly overwhelming. This is what Ezekiel says. It's in chapter 1, verse 28. Such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord. And when I saw it, I fell on my face. And I heard the voice of one speaking. It was shattering when Ezekiel glimpsed the glory of God. But then he heard the voice of God. God the Lord, Yahweh, spoke to Ezekiel. He lifted him to his feet. And then he told Ezekiel that he had work for him to do. The Lord was sending Ezekiel as his prophet, as his spokesman, to the nation of Israel. And the message that Ezekiel had to relay to the Israelites from the Lord was not a reassuring, comforting, happy message. Ezekiel had to go to them and warn them that God was going to bring far more terrible judgments on them than anything that had happened so far. Why? Because they were a rebellious house. They'd rebelled against God. That was why he had sent the Babylonians against them already. And they were still rebelling against God. They hadn't repented despite everything that God had already brought on them. And the so-called prophets who were telling them that God was on their side were just lying. The truth was that God was against them. He was against them because of their sins and their disobedience and their rebellion. And Ezekiel had to tell them so. God's message to the Israelites was that there was utter misery and ruin and horror ahead for them. And Ezekiel had to make that message his own. He had to get it into his own system. It had to become part of himself. He had to feel it inside himself and then to preach it to the Israelites. In his vision, the way it seemed was that God was giving him the message already written down on a scroll. And Ezekiel had to eat the scroll. The scroll, we're told in chapter 2, verse 10, was full of words of lamentation and mourning and woe. And Ezekiel had to eat those words of lamentation and mourning and woe. He had to become a man with a belly full of pain and misery. He couldn't preach it to others unless he first felt the reality of it in his own soul. Well, that first vision of God left Ezekiel shattered and overwhelmed. He says that when it was all over, he just sat there for 7 days among the other people in the camp, overwhelmed, dazed by what he'd experienced. It says that in chapter 3, verse 15. But then at the end of 7 days, chapter 3, verse 16, God spoke to him again. This time there was no vision, but he knew God was speaking to him. The word of the Lord came to me, he says. And as God spoke to Ezekiel, God showed him what his role was to be. God had appointed Ezekiel to be a watchman. A watchman stands on the walls of a city, looking out for any danger that could threaten the city. And if he sees any danger, then he blows a trumpet or he shouts a warning. Well, Ezekiel's job was to shout out to the people of Israel that they were in danger, that God was coming against them as an enemy. And Ezekiel had to warn them to repent or face disaster. And if he failed to do that, God would hold him responsible. Yes, the Israelites would die in their sins, but their blood would be on Ezekiel's hands. It was a frightening responsibility that God was laying on Ezekiel. If we know God, if we know God's word, there's a frightening responsibility on us to warn the people around us that they are in danger. Well, that's the point we've reached in this book of Ezekiel. We're at chapter 3, verse 22. And if you think that over these past weeks we've read some strange and puzzling things in this book, I warn you that what's coming next is far more weird. Ezekiel says in verse 22, "The hand of the Lord was upon me there." This isn't one of his visions. He's not seeing anything at this point, but he can feel the presence of God with him. It's as if there's a great hand pressing down on him. He feels crushed under the weight of the responsibility that God is laying on him, the role that he has to play. It's like a great weight on his shoulders. And then God speaks to him again. And this is what God says: arise, go out into the valley. Or as the footnote has it, onto the plain. Out into the desert. Away from the canal. Away from the people. And there I'll speak to you. So Ezekiel arose. Ezekiel went out into the valley, or out into the desert. And behold, he says, the glory of the Lord stood there, like the glory that I had seen by the Chebar canal. And he fell, and I fell on my face. He sees again this extraordinary vision of the glory of God, the great storm cloud, the flashes of lightning, the great four-faced beasts, the whirling wheels, and above them all the throne. And on the throne, God himself, in the likeness of a man, but a man blazing with fire and light and glory. Ezekiel sees it all again. And again, he's flat on his face. He's prostrate before God. You know, there are some things you can get used to. The first time you see them, they're overwhelming, they're majestic, they're awesome. But each time you see them, they make less impact on you. Until finally you just take them for granted. You forget how big and grand they are. It isn't like that with God. Each time you become aware of God and what he's like, it's as overwhelming, maybe it's more overwhelming than it was first time. Ezekiel is on his face again before God, just as he was first time. But once again, God's Spirit comes upon him. Verse 24, God's Spirit enters into him. God's Spirit sets him on his feet. And God speaks to him. God gives him a command. But what a strange command it is. This is what God says to Ezekiel. Go, shut yourself within your house. Ezekiel is going to spend the next year, or rather more than a year, locked up inside his own home. And what sort of state is he going to be in? Verse 25. And you, O son of man, behold, cords will be placed upon you, and you shall be bound with them, so that you cannot go out among the people. Ezekiel's going to find that he's tied down. He's incapable of leaving the house. Who's going to tie him down? Well, that's not made clear until you get to chapter 4, verse 8, where the Lord says, I will put cords upon you. The Lord is going to make it impossible for Ezekiel to move. I don't think we're talking literal ropes. We're talking about some sort of paralysis imposed by God upon Ezekiel that will make it impossible for him to get out and leave the house. Ezekiel's going to find he can't move, or at least he can't move his legs. From what follows, it's clear that he's not going to be completely paralyzed, but he is going to be immobile, at least much of the time. What a bewildering thing for God to do. He tells Ezekiel that he's got the job of preaching to the Israelites, and then he says, I'm going to tie you down with cords. You're not going to be able to leave your home. But there's worse to come. He says this, and I will make your tongue cling to the roof of your mouth, so that you shall be mute and unable to reprove them, for they are a rebellious house. So he's going to be incapable of talking. This paralysis is going to affect his speech. His tongue is going to be stuck to the roof of his mouth. He's going to be tongue-tied. God's given him a message of warning to speak to Israel, but he's not going to be able to preach it, at least not with spoken words. He will be unable to reprove them. Now, the Lord makes it clear that this isn't going to be permanent. He says to Ezekiel in verse 27, but when I speak with you, I will open your mouth, and you shall say to them, thus says the Lord God. And then he who will hear, let him hear, and he who will refuse to hear, let him refuse. Ezekiel will be able to speak eventually, but only when the Lord opens his mouth. And then it will be clear that the words he speaks do come from the Lord and not from Ezekiel himself. Ezekiel isn't going to be allowed to say anything of his own accord. Nobody's going to be able to say, well, that was just Ezekiel's opinion. Because Ezekiel will be basically a dumb man. The only time he'll be able to speak is when God speaks and releases Ezekiel from his dumbness. When the Lord says, I will open your mouth, and then you'll speak to them. I don't know if this means that Ezekiel will be dumb for most of the time, but that there will be moments when he's given back his speech and can speak God's words. So he's just got the capacity to speak intermittently. Or whether it's saying that this dumbness is going to be constant until a particular day comes when God will remove it and open his mouth and he'll speak God's words. I think it's probably the second. But the important thing, the thing that's clear, is that Ezekiel, the man whom God has chosen as his prophet, is going to be confined to his house with some sort of paralysis that affects both his mobility and his speech. He's going to be in cords, and his tongue is going to be stuck to the roof of his mouth. Yes, it may be intermittent. There may be times when he is able to get up and move around. There will be some things he will be capable of doing. We'll see that. There may be times when the Lord opens his mouth and speaks. But this is going to be his normal state for the foreseeable future. If people come to Ezekiel's house, that's the way that they'll see him. I did warn you it was going to be weird. What was God doing? Why reduce Ezekiel to this state? And how is Ezekiel supposed to function as a prophet, as a watchman, as God's spokesman, when he's been reduced to this condition? Well, the fact is that in this state, Ezekiel is going to speak more powerfully to the Israelites than he could in any other way. And that's what we're going to see in chapter 4. God has told Ezekiel he's going to be subjected to this terrible ordeal. Now, in chapter 4, he tells Ezekiel how he's got to prepare for it and what he's going to be doing during this time. He tells Ezekiel that when Ezekiel gets home, he's got to take a brick. We're talking about a flat mud brick. the sort that they'd use in Babylon, maybe for paving. The experts tell me it might be about the size of a sheet of A3. And while it's still soft, Ezekiel's got to engrave on it a sketch of a city. What city? The city of Jerusalem. And he's going to lay that down on the floor of his house. And then he's going to build around it a model. Think something like a model train layout. Except that it's not stations and bridges. He's got to build models of siege works around the city. A mound, battering rams, the camp of a besieging army. Anyone who looks at Ezekiel's model is going to see the city of Jerusalem being besieged all around by an attacking army. They'll recognize the city and they'll understand what Ezekiel's model means. Jerusalem was spared when the Babylonians came up 5 years earlier. They surrendered and there was no need for a siege. But the Babylonians are going to return. And this time it will be far worse. Because this time they're going to bring up all their battery of armaments. And they're not going to be in any mood for mercy this time. Jerusalem is going to face a terrible siege from a determined army. That's what the people who visit Ezekiel's house will see portrayed there on the floor. But they won't just see the model. They're going to see something much more significant. They'll see Ezekiel himself. Where will he be? He'll be lying on the floor. Unmoving. Remember, he's tied down by the Lord's cords. He's just lying there on the floor, immobile, staring at that besieged city. The Lord tells him how he's got to be. Chapter 4, verse 4, he's got to take an iron griddle, a big plate of iron, and he's got to place it as an iron wall between himself and his model city. And then he's got to set his face towards the city. He's got to keep his eye on it undeviating. He's got to keep his eye trained on that city, come what may. Verse 7, you shall set your face towards the siege of Jerusalem with your arm bared, and you shall prophesy against the city. And behold, I will place cords on you, so that you cannot turn from one side to the other, till you have completed the days of your siege. Can you see Ezekiel? Lying on the floor, unmoving, unable even to roll over to lie on his other side, with his face set towards the city that he's sketched on the brick. And he's gazing at it, and his arms bare. You bare your arm when you're about to use it in some forceful way. When you're about to draw your sword, or where you're about to throw a punch. But he's not doing anything like that. He's just lying there motionless with an iron wall between himself and the besieged city. The Lord says to him in verse 7, you'll be prophesying against the city. That may mean that from time to time I'll untie your tongue, set you free to speak, and you'll actually speak words against Jerusalem. It may mean that, but I don't think so. I think the Lord is saying that this whole scene, this whole drawn-out scenario, is one long prophecy against Jerusalem. Ezekiel is preaching against Jerusalem. He's telling everyone who will listen that disaster is coming to Jerusalem, and he doesn't need to use words. That motionless body lying on the floor, its eyes trained on the city, tells them everything they need to know. Who is Ezekiel representing? He's representing God himself. Remember, he's a priest of God. The priest is the man who's called to be God's visible representative to the people. And that's what Ezekiel is. More than that, he's God's prophet. He's the man into whom God's Spirit has come. He's the Son of Man, the man who's stamped with God's image. God's message has become part of him. He's devoured it. And now in his own body, he's playing out God's intentions. He's giving everyone who walks into that house a glimpse of what God is doing and what God is intending to do. I'm sure the news went through the camp very quickly that something strange has happened to Ezekiel. Maybe they know already that he had some sort of strange prophetic vision a week earlier, that he'd come back from the Chebar Canal shaking, stuttering about seeing God's glory. And now they hear that he's confined to his home, that he's in some sort of trance, that he's incapable of walking or speaking. People come to his house, they're drawn by curiosity or compassion. And what do they see? As they walk through the door, they see their beloved city, the city they've come from, the city they're dreaming of returning to. And it's there, but it's surrounded by armies. There's a mound built up against its walls. There are battering rams ready to smash down the gates. And there's Ezekiel. He's lying on the floor, his face glaring at it. His arm is bare. His hand is clenched round an iron plate, a griddle. Perhaps they wonder what he's going to do. Now that he's got an audience, maybe he's going to leap to his feet and kick the siege weapons and the battering rams out of the way. Maybe he's going to trample the camp of the besieging army into the dust. But no, he just lies there, staring, holding out that iron plate in his hand. 10 minutes go by. 20 minutes go by. An hour goes by. Some of them get bored and leave. And then they come back at evening time to find out what happened. And he's still lying there. And they come back the following morning, fully expecting to see that the besieging army has been removed and the city has been rescued. And he's still lying there. And his eyes are still trained relentlessly on the scene. And the iron plate is still gripped in his hand. And suddenly they realize he's not defending the city. He's not going to leap up and sweep away the attackers. He's not going to intervene at all. He's not moving. That iron plate in his hand isn't a weapon he's going to use to break up the siege. It's a wall. It's a barrier between himself and the city. Maybe it's more than that. After all, it's a griddle. And what's a griddle for? You heat it till it's scorching hot. And you use it to burn things. Maybe that iron griddle is a sign that the city is going to be scorched, burned. And as they look at Ezekiel's face, they see how implacably it's set against the city. And they realize that he is willing forward the attackers. The Lord didn't just say to Ezekiel, "Watch while the siege goes forward." He said to Ezekiel, chapter 4, verse 3,
set your face towards the city and let it be in a state of siege, and you press the siege against it. The look on Ezekiel's face would have told you that he was pressing this siege forward. He was willing forward the attackers. And they begin to realize what God is saying. Yes, Jerusalem is going to be besieged. And no, God is not going to intervene. There's a wall, there's an iron barrier between God and the people of Jerusalem. As far as helping them goes, he will not, he cannot show mercy to these stubborn, unrepentant, ungrateful people. He's not going to. If anything, he will drive the besiegers forward. Ezekiel, lying there on the floor of his house, has become a real picture of God. But there's more. Because a priest isn't just supposed to represent God to the people, he's also supposed to represent the people to God. Ezekiel, lying there on the floor of his house, is showing the people what God is like. But he's also got to show the people what they are like in the sight of God. And that's what you see in the rest of chapter 4. God tells him in verses 4 to 5 that he's going to be lying there on his left side for 390 days. Remember in verse 7, he's told he won't be able to turn over from one side to the other. For more than a year, he's going to be left lying there on his left side. And then he'll find he can get up. But only to lie down again on his right side. And that's the way he'll be for another 40 days. That's what we're told in verse 46. That's how long his ordeal will last. A total of 430 days. 390 lying on one side, 40 on the other. What's he going to eat during that time? Well, that's part of his preparation as well. When he gets home now, he's got to take, he's told, wheat and barley, beans and lentils, millet and emmet, and he's got to store them all in a big jar. And he'll make his bread from them. Obviously, at some point each day, he is allowed to move. He can't get up, his legs won't work, but he'll struggle from his position on the floor to bake a loaf of bread. He'll cook it, we're told in verses 12 to 15, on a fire fueled with dung. From a Jewish point of view, that would make the food unclean. He was told initially it should be human dung. Later, as a special concession, he's told you can cook it on cow's dung. But it would still make it unclean. And this is a starvation diet. Every day the food is weighed out. 20 shekels a day. That's about 8 ounces. A sixth part of a hin of water. That's a pint and a bit. And that's what he'll be living on. That's his daily ration. For 430 days, he's going to get thinner and thinner. For more than a year, the Israelites are going to see this man starving before their eyes. Can't imagine what sort of state his body is going to be in by the end of the time. It's going to be skin and bones. And he's going to have the most appalling bed sores, except he doesn't have a bed. As far as you know, maybe he's lying on a mattress. He's going to be rotting away. God's prophet is going to suffer appallingly. But why? What's it all about? Well, you've got your answer in verse 4. This is what God says to Ezekiel: lie on your left side and place the punishment, literally it's just place the iniquity, place the sin of the house of Israel upon it. For the number of days that you lie on your left side, you shall bear their punishment. For I assign to you a number of days, 390 days, equal to the number of the years of their punishment. And again in verse 6, when you have completed these, you shall lie down a second time, but on your right side, and bear the punishment of the house of Judah. 40 days I assign you, a day for each year. The misery, the nightmare that Ezekiel endures is a picture of the punishment that Israel deserves. And every day that he endures is a reminder of a year. 390 days to mark 390 years for which the house of Israel needs to be punished. 40 days to mark 40 years for which the house of Judah needs to be punished. By the house of Israel, I think he means the whole nation. From the time when Israel rebelled against God and started worshipping false gods, that was back in the days of Solomon, right up to the time when Jerusalem was destroyed, that was reckoned as 390 years. By the house of Judah, I think he means the actual people alive and living in Jerusalem and Judea in his own time, his own generation. The generation was always counted as 40 years. When people looked at Ezekiel, paralyzed, starving, speechless, rotting away, what they were seeing was themselves. The state to which all these years of rebellion had brought them. The punishment that they had brought upon themselves by their rebellion right up to that day. Look at verse 16. Son of man, behold, I will break the supply of bread in Jerusalem. They shall eat bread by weight and with anxiety, and they shall drink water by measure and in dismay. I will do this that they may lack bread and water and look at one another in dismay and rot away because of their punishment. Everything that Ezekiel was suffering was a picture of what these people were going to suffer at the hands of God. They're looking at Ezekiel now with horror and dismay. Well, one day the people of Jerusalem will be looking at one another with horror and dismay. They can see Ezekiel living on this starvation diet. One day they're going to starve. They can see him rotting away now. One day they will rot away under the judgment of God. And this is how Ezekiel has got to relay God's message to the Israelites. Not first and foremost with words, but by becoming a living, visible picture to them of the dreadful situation they're in. He's going to be a picture to them of God, the God who they've provoked, the God who's going to treat them as enemies, the God who's going to lay siege to them. And he's got to be a picture to them of themselves and the horrible state to which they're going to be brought when God acts to punish them. Well, that's tonight's chapter. I'll say again, there are lots of puzzling, very difficult things in the chapter. Lots of details where I can't be sure the right way to explain them. There are lots of points where I've gone for what I think is the most likely understanding, but where others might disagree. There are some things here we can't be sure of. but the main facts come through with crystal clarity. And these are facts, remember. This is the record of what actually happened there in that transit camp by the river Chebar in Babylon. The reason this was all written down is because this is exactly what happened to Ezekiel. And of course, the things that he was warning the Israelites about did actually come to pass. 5 years or so later, after Ezekiel had received this message in the year 587 BC, the Babylonians did march against Jerusalem, and they did besiege the city. And after the people of Israel had suffered months of the most appalling misery, and after they had starved, the Babylonians did break through, and they did destroy the city and the temple, and the whole nation was scattered, and they did rot away in exile. Ezekiel was a true prophet. We're reading about things that really happened. Before I finish for tonight, let me read to you what one commentator says about this chapter. This is how he opens his commentary on the passage we've been looking at. Many of the prophets were gifted actors. In today's world, they would have been exponents of physical theatre, exploiting the potential of gesture and mime, even elements of burlesque and clowning. And all this was in addition to the amazing toolkit of rhetorical techniques and verbal imagery they could draw on. None of them, however, was called upon to use visual drama in such a bizarre and sustained way as Ezekiel. This is one-man street theatre with a very powerful message. So, this commentator tells us, what we learn from this chapter is that in the modern world, we should use physical theatre, gesture, mime, even elements of burlesque and miming to communicate God's message. What we've got here is Ezekiel giving us an example of visual drama, one man's street theatre, and we need to follow his lead. I met the same argument before. We're told we ought to be like Ezekiel, using drama to communicate to the people around us. There's only one problem about using the chapter in that way. Ezekiel wasn't acting. He really was crippled. He really was tongue-tied. He really was starving. It wasn't just careful makeup. He wasn't just acting a part. He really did become an expression of what God was doing in that situation. He really did experience in himself the punishment that the wicked people of Jerusalem deserved. It wasn't a pretense at suffering. He really was suffering. When people came to Ezekiel's house, they didn't come away saying, "Oh, what a clever actor. Didn't he play the role of a paralyzed, tongue-tied man cleverly?" They knew they'd seen the real thing. They'd glimpsed God as he really is, made visible in the actions of one man. And they'd glimpsed sin and its consequences in the sufferings, the real sufferings of that one man. This one man gave them a picture of both God the Punisher and the people he was determined to punish. But it wasn't just a picture, it was reality. Now, what we need and what we need to communicate to others is just the same as what those Israelites needed. We need to see God as he really is. And we need to see ourselves and our sinfulness as it really is. And if Ezekiel has helped to show us those things, that's great. I could carry on talking about Ezekiel, showing Ezekiel to you in the hope that you'll understand those things more clearly. But I'm not going to. And I'm certainly not going to invent some drama, a bit of one-man theatre, as an alternative way of showing those things to you. I don't need to. Instead, I'm going to move you forward 600 years and more from Ezekiel's time. And I'm going to take you to a hill outside Jerusalem. And I'm going to show you a man hanging from a cross that's standing on that hill. And he's been reduced to a far worse state than Ezekiel was reduced to in that house. This man has been nailed to that cross. He's got nails that have really been driven through his hands and his feet. He's not tied down by invisible cords. He's pinned to that cross by those nails. And he is naked. And his body has been twisted out of shape. And it's been battered and bruised beyond recognition. That man's name is Jesus. And what is happening to Jesus? He's being punished. He's being punished by God. He's as helpless as Ezekiel was. He can't move. He can't turn from side to side because he's pinned there. And he's experiencing the punishing hand of God. Because he's taking the blame for human wickedness. God is pouring out his anger against Jesus. His anger for all the wicked things human beings have done. This man, Jesus, is being scorched. He's being gutted. He's being destroyed by the anger of God. He's taking the punishment that I deserve. And this man, Jesus, who is a real man, is God himself. Because God has become a man. And it's God who's hanging there on that cross. God has become both the punisher and the punished. So I don't need any actor now, any dramatist, any mime artist to show me what God is like or to show me what human beings deserve, because this is the real thing. This is God showing me how much he hates sin. How much he hates greed and pride and selfishness and lust. He hates them so much that he'll lay them all on Jesus. And then he'll expose Jesus to this appalling ordeal. Jesus will cry out under the weight of the punishment that's laid upon him. My God, why have you abandoned me? I don't need a man to lie on the floor for a year to show me what sin deserves. I certainly don't need some clever Christian actor to give me a new picture of what sin deserves. I've only got to look at Jesus, strung out on that cross, sobbing, broken, crying out, I'm thirsty. I've only got to look at him to see the truth. I hear those terrible words, why have you abandoned me? And I know that's what sin deserves. That's what I deserve. To be abandoned by God forever, to sink into a bottomless pit of loneliness. I know that that's what my sin will lead to if it's not dealt with, if it's not taken away, if it's not forgiven. I know that's what human sin does. It leads to God abandoning people. Because I can see it happening at Calvary. Jesus himself is the sign we've been given. The Israelites were given a sign. They were given Ezekiel lying there in his misery. There they saw God's anger. There they saw the punishment man deserved. But we've been given the greater sign. We've been given not a Son of Man. We've been given the Son of Man. The cross is the great demonstration. It's there we see God the Punisher, once for all, showing his hatred, his fury against human sin. And it's there we see human sin being punished, as the man Jesus endures the wrath of God. God in time past spoke to our fathers through the prophets. Many times. Lots of different fragmentary ways. He was speaking through Ezekiel. He was speaking through Ezekiel's experiences. But oh, how fragmentary it was. What a little glimpse it was. In these last days he has spoken to us by his Son. And where do we see the truth most clearly? We see it there at Calvary. We see it at the cross. We see the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ.